double ridge waveguide is a simpler approach, and I wonder if you can see, can you see some light at the end of that particular tunnel with that approach, Glenn? KC2QIQ, KQLIW in the thick there.
Oh, I sure do, and I know it would be a heck of a lot less expensive than a GTAM. TESEC is the company that, in Germany, who took over the manufacture of them, the gigahertz transverse electromagnetic cells. Those chambers are actually very nice. I've used the one exclusively over in Dayton T. Brown. They got a nice one over there about the dimensions of the size you mentioned. When I was working at Fihang, they had one over in their California facility over there that was maybe about a 10-footer. So that was, you know, a nice little in-house one. So whenever I had to make measurements and I didn't have the time to go over to Dayton, I could fly out to California and spend a week or so playing with the little one over there. And, they're expensive. But very, very useful tools. But I see where you're coming from, though, Dick. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
The interesting fact is that someone could make a lot of money. This is interesting because all he needs is just the shear and bending device. I'm trying to be humoristic and tricky.
Yeah, the double grid wave guide made out of a galvanized steel, for instance, or aluminum. But galvanized steel would be nice because you can easily shield it, you can easily solder to it, connect to it, and don't worry about the aluminum oxide buildup and scratching contacts and so on. I think we're talking about $50 worth of material here. Whereas if you went and bought that GTEM, I'm guessing that's around $10,000 or more. What's your rough guess, though, Glenn, as to what a GTEM would cost brand new today? And that's not the kind of an item you're going to find on eBay. It's like saying, I want to buy a space simulating chamber that used to be used at the Goddard Space Flight Center. You ain't going to find that at eBay. Got a guess as to what a brand new GTEM would cost, Glenn, KC2QIQ, K2LAW?
It all depends on the size, Dick. I mean, if you want to get like a little 10-footer, that would probably cost you, probably about 12, 15,000, somewhere in there. You want to go for those big ones, like the big one over at Dayton. That one is going to probably cost you in the area of about $500,000. So they're custom-made pieces, and the door to get in and out of the chamber, that's all like special custom gold finger stock. I mean, that's quite a piece of material there. In fact, you, Dick.
That's something interesting for you guys.
And you can see why we're not recommending the GTEM. Wes has got the money to do it, but I don't think he should spend his money that way. Go ahead, Wes. Wait for the beeps.
I'm a cheap, cool guy, I found something. 700 megahertz to 18 gigahertz, double reach, broadband wave guide antenna, 900 bucks. Starting bit, 1150. And interesting. Can you imagine 700 megahertz up to 18 gigahertz? But there is one that is also 421.9 bucks, and it is from 4.5 to 11 gigahertz. But the first one is really impressive. I told you.
Yeah, what you have double confirmed is that properly constructed double ridge waveguide can have an extremely wide frequency region over which it performs in a predictable manner. Ordinary round or rectangular waveguide, you have a double devil of a problem making it work beyond half or three quarters of an octave, so to speak. I don't think any of the waveguides, let's see now, WR90 X-band waveguide is rated from 8 to 12. Yeah, that's a small fraction of one octave. Whereas double ridge guide can work over a whole lot of octaves. So, and although you found eBay pieces of double ridge waveguide, which maybe are in your price region, there's no real great magic there for your particular requirement. You don't have to have mil-spec, silver-plated, with fancy flanges, double ridge waveguide. You're building a kind of a chamber, but it's being built in the design of a double ridge waveguide. So with a little bit of study, I know you can homebrew that out of sheet metal. The ham radio operator, that's the best thing they can do in the world. making homebrew antennas. You take a look at, let me drop it.
Case 2Q, sorry, Dick, but can I give you a little story about the GSM later?
Yes, you can. But you take, for instance, you go to the website of Kent Britton, Whiskey Alpha 5, Victor Juliet Bravo, W5DJB. You go to his website. He sells printed circuit antennas. But you go to his second or third page, he will show you how to make an extremely high-performance 2-meter Yagi or 432 Yagi out of coat hanger wire. And there's another article that's on Bernie's site, KQIO, on how the Rochester Amateur Radio Group, the Rah-Rah Group, built these very high-performance 3 and 4-element Yagis out of the yellow carpenter's tape, the expandable ruler-type tape. You can build an antenna out of that, which very easily, you just wipe your hands over it, it folds up, you put it into the boot of the car, as the Brits would say, you put it in the trunk, and when you want to go out and do some bunny hunting, you take this thing out of the trunk of the car, the carpenter tape, the steel tape, just pops into the right position, and there's a high-performance Yagi. And so that article is on Bernie's website right now, K2 Yankee Oscar. So go ahead and give us a couple of words about a GTEM, a very fancy machine, but very pricey. KC2QIQ, K2RIW, very good.
Yeah, just a little funny story about how I got introduced to the GTEM. I ran into a little predicament about, about 4 or 5 years ago, where I was working on some LED products and I needed to get them completed. I had to get them through qualification testing, and I was calling up labs all over the place to try to get time. And I was getting put off by, weeks and weeks and weeks. And I was like, well, not only do I have to qualify, but I might have to also do some additional testing to make sure I'm passing first. So to take up, a week's block of time, most of these labs in their 10-meter chambers and everything else, they just weren't available. And then, except they said, but we do have a G10. This is what they told me over at Dave G. Brown. I never heard of such a thing before in my life. And basically, it turned out, let me let it drop for a second. It seemed like everybody else who was doing testing and was basically scheduling all the labs were going for the big 10-meter chambers and all the other chambers and the other measurements, and they were telling me nobody really uses the G10. And it turned out, Dick, believe it or not, I had almost exclusive use of the G10 at Dayton P. Brown. Nobody else would use it. It was like every time I'd schedule time, I could always get right in there within any day of the week to do any kind of testing that I needed, because nobody either liked it or there was a lot of people just thumbed their nose up in the air. So it's like the only thing I would ever have to wait for time getting into Dayton for wasn't for the chamber time. It was to make sure that they had the correct other instrumentation, the amplifiers or the spectrum analyzer or whatever additional piece of equipment that was necessary. But that was all I had to wait for, Dick. Otherwise, I could just go around the block and start testing. KC2QIQ.
Yeah, most people think that a GTEM is only used for applying signals to a circuit under test, like measuring immunity or susceptibility. They don't realize that it obeys the law of reciprocity. If you want to find out what extraneous signals are being emitted, what undesired electromagnetic interference is coming back out of your circuit, a GTEM is a beautiful way to measure it. So the GTEM can measure circuits going in or coming out, and with XYZ axis orientation, frequency sweep, whatever. What's happening, I'm guessing, Glenn, is that essentially none of the schools teach you about susceptibility testing, teach you about a GTEM. That thing at Dayton T. Brown is an extremely useful tool, which wasn't being used because of an extreme lack of education in the technical community that should be using it. That's my opinion. What's your opinion on that one, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LIW, and the TechNet?
Oh, I completely agree, Dick. I mean, certainly I've done that kind of testing many, many times. And the funny part was, when I say I did the testing, generally the test engineers over at Dayton P. Brown really conduct all the testing. I'm really just going there with a sample, telling them what specifications I want scanned and tested. But unless I'm doing some troubleshooting or something where I'm actually getting in to the product itself and making some changes and things. But in general, people, they look at it and it just looks foreign to them. the first time I looked at it, I was like, oh my goodness, what is this wedge-shaped chamber? As I said, the only reason I got so familiar with it was because of need at the time. I needed the test time to get in there, and it was the only thing that was available because everybody stuck their nose up in the air. So, and I found out what a wonderful piece of equipment it is. And I could get in and out of there in no time. And actually, to set up in there, because of the way that the chamber is configured, you can actually have a table that's automated, so you don't even have to go inside and out of the chamber. You can basically strap it on the table, and you can set it up, and basically it's motorized. The table's motorized inside, so you can do everything external from it, do X, Y, and Z, change all the polarities and everything from outside the chamber without even going inside, instead of, resetting up the Yagi antennas and moving the test sample around, which is a real pain in the neck. And you get very, very fast information if you're using a nice fast scan like a Rodin-Schwarz spectrum analyzer, too. K2IW, K2QIQ.
See the kind of inner secrets you guys are hearing? You're now knowing what the majority of the world of electrical engineering, wireless engineers, know nothing about. They don't know what a SATAMO is. They don't know what a GTEM is. You guys are hearing this inner secret. You're going through your apprenticeship by listening to this jazz. Hey, John, now, we promised everybody that we're only going to take an hour for the questions and answers before going to the mailbag, and we're only 2.25 hours beyond our schedule. That's close. What kind of fantastic questions have you gotten this week, John? KC2WGB, K2LIW, and the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Well, Dick, I got some commentary, a return message here from one of the gentlemen who was listening about the large hairpin pipe. He went out to do that job, and some interesting results there. I'll just cover this for tonight because we got to get to Paul, and it's quite late. The other ones are probably sleeping by now, but he wanted us to know that those UHF walkie-talkies did work in the pipe. The pipe, as I explained to you, it's 2 meters in diameter, and it's all metal, all steel. Smooth wall inside. Let me let it drop. And it is on a rise of approximately 2.5 degrees for moisture and the condensation to run out. It has a small nylon mat that you walk on, which is only maybe a quarter of an inch thick, and it's about a foot wide in the center. That's the only thing in that chamber, and the radios worked fine. But he did find one strange thing. His partner, who had the other radio on the other side, was basically at a fixed location. As he walked through the pipe, the communication in the exact center of the pipe was very poor at times, although it worked, but it was very poor. If he walked slightly to one wall or the other by about a foot, the reception was perfect. So I just thought you'd like to know that worked out fine. And he finally let me know what that project's all about.
So the pipe was 2 meters wide, or 2 meters in diameter, 6 foot in diameter. I'm not quite sure how long the pipe was. I believe it had a U-shaped bend, and then another chunk of pipe after the U-shaped bend. And when you come back, you're going to give us the length of the pipe. I believe that under some conditions, that pipe could be a mile long and give you a pretty good signal. If you studied the diagrams that are in a couple of the good books on how waveguide works, round or rectangular waveguide, by the way, has an extremely similar theory of operation. You would think, common sense, that the radio signal is going to go right down the center of the pipe, just like your eyesight. Let me drop. Absolutely, positively does not do that. At all reasonable frequencies, a piece of round or rectangular waveguide, the signal bounces back and forth. In the case of rectangular waveguide, it bounces back and forth between the narrow walls. Again, opposite of common sense. Bounces back and forth between the narrow walls at an extremely specific angle once you know the frequency and the dimensions of the waveguide. Because you know about this, the way it's bouncing, it's quite possible that as he holds his handy talkie off of center with a particular orientation, there's a, orientations of the handy-talkie that's doing the transmitting and a couple of orientations that's where it's doing the receiving will give you the most reliable communication. But this is a beautiful example of the proof of multipath. In other words, whenever you set up a radio signal, it's a little bit like taking a bushel basket full of perfect ping-pong balls and throwing them into the room, scattering them very rapidly into the room. They're going to bounce off everything. The radio signal is doing that, bouncing off every possible combination, every possible angle. And now, let me drop. As that radio wave takes all of those bounces, there's going to be hot spots and cold spots where some of the bounces come out co-phase and antiphase. Take a relatively weak repeater that you're listening to with your handy talkie and walk around your room and hold it high, low, left, right, tilted horizontal, vertical, slant 45 right, slant 45 left, tilted forward, tilted back. You'll find out there's a whole lot of specific orientations and specific locations of your handy talkie within the room of your house where the signal gets strong and weak. As I've told you guys a lot of times, when I put the handy talkie on 146.85 megahertz and I want to listen to it while I'm shaving in my bathroom, I have to lay it horizontal on the plastic shelf in order to get best reception, even though I know that that repeater is purely vertically polarized. So radio is funny stuff, and therefore there are going to be specific locations in that pipe where you see peaks and valleys. So what was the approximate length of the pipe, Paul? Here we go, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, like I said, it was 6 meters in two meters in diameter, and it was a half a mile, and it was shaped like a hairpin.
Okay, and the hairpin itself, was it a mitered joint, or was it a gradual round joint? The hairpin where it made the 180-degree turn, what did that look like, John, K2LIW?
Dick, it was a smooth radius and a constant radius for the whole turn. And I wondered how they built this thing. They didn't excavate. How the hell did they get all of this pipe in there? Evidently, it was put in sections. Maybe they used a tunnel boring machine, that I don't know. Somehow they excavated the tunnel, and this thing fits perfectly in that tunnel. Amazing construction. Nice job.
What state is that in, John? And what's the purpose of the tunnel? Is it a way of transporting equipment to a particular underground site? Go ahead.
No, Dick. Arizona, and it's built into a hill. And the idea of this pipe is this is a test for air conditioning with geothermal. What they're going to do is they have a building that they're going to construct. It's a fair-sized building. And they're going to use the cool soil earth to actually chill this building. And they believe they can operate it with a 5-horsepower motor. And that will be driven by either a wind turbine or solar cells. So they can do it either way. So great project.
It sounds like a very green geothermal heat sink. A buddy of mine owns a heat pump in his house, and in the wintertime, let me call it air conditioning coils on the outside of the house would take air at minus 20 degrees Fahrenheit, cool it to 0 degrees Fahrenheit, take that heat out of the air, and pump it into his house. He was heating his house with outside, what you and I would call frozen air. That's the good news. The bad news is those coils on the outside were also getting frost on them from that process. And so periodically, the thing would have to reverse its operation to heat up the coils, to melt away the frost, and then continue the operation. And below a certain outside temperature, the amount of horsepower of the air conditioning required to pump that heat uphill, so to speak, starts getting higher than the amount of kilowatt hours you would use with resistive I squared R heating. So there's a trade-off there. But in fact, also another place where a lot of heating and cooling takes place, let me drop, is that HBO, for instance, has a satellite out in space, that ground station used to be in Hapag, probably still is, and there are these 600-watt traveling wave tube transmitters transmitting a signal up to them, and the transmitter itself has to dissipate lots of kilowatts of power, and in the wintertime, they use that power to heat the building. In the summertime, they draw water out of a well, use the water as a cooling substance, and then pump the hot water back down into an adjacent well. So they're also using geothermal heating and cooling. So that can be a very green operation when it's done correctly. With a wind-powered source of energy running the air conditioning-like equipment, using the pipe in the soil as a heat sink. In the wintertime, it's a source of heat. In the summertime, it's a source of cooling. Because I am guessing if you go deep enough into the soil, the temperature at that place is relatively constant almost all year round. Is that approximately the theory of operation, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW?
Absolutely correct, Dick. I don't know about heating, but they were talking about cooling. And it seems to be they had between 51 and 52 degrees almost constantly, and the soil is moist that it's in contact with, so the heat transfer is excellent. And he says it's kind of chilly in there.
Yeah, you got to wear a jacket. So I presume they're using 2-watt handy talkies. To your knowledge, were they doing this on 450 commercial frequencies? 450 ham radio, 2-meter ham radio. Have any idea what frequencies were being used? Because all of them will work to various degrees of success. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
They had two types. They had 800 megahertz, which they said did not perform as well, but the one that worked perfectly was the 470 megahertz.
Yeah, the 800 should work. Although, the picket fence rate at 800 megs as you walk in the tunnel is going to be considerably faster. Shorter wavelength, higher frequency. So the 470 would work. 2 meters might work even better. See if you can talk them in doing the experiment, John, at 146 megacycles, ham radio-wise. Because it's all a shielded environment underground, it's a little bit like a carrier current radio station. Carrier current radio station, you're allowed to transmit on the normal AM frequencies as long as you're not jamming the local radio station, and as long as on the campus of your college the signal leaving the campus is below some number like 15 microvolts per meter, so it's not jamming the outside world. Within your campus, you're allowed to transmit power through the 60-cycle wiring and have every student in all of their dorm rooms listen to the same radio station if you want to. And this situation is somewhat like that. Over to you, John, and you go to another one if you want to. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, Dick, that's where you need one of those antennas where it drops dead after so many feet, there's no more signal. Solves the issue. They found that the 800 megahertz was limited to half a watt or a watt. I think they only had two positions on that. But the 470 were 5 watt and 3 watt. So they used them on 5 watt and absolutely no problem. It was really, he was really happy. And he's glad he brought the walkie-talkies out there. Saved him a lot. Because they were talking about using wired sound phones and stuff like that. That's a pain.
Yeah, wireless is much nicer. Tremendous portability. There's roughly 20 different kinds of wireless products being used in the United States today. Roughly 20. You add up all of the what used to be beepers and pagers and remote control of the automobile, remote control of the garage door, remote control of the television set, cell phone. You add it all up. There's roughly 20 wireless products. Every one of those products requires an antenna to work well. Requires a good transmitter and a good receiver. In our schools, we teach people a little bit about how to build transmitters and receivers. We do not teach them how to build antennas. Every one of those companies that build those 20 kinds of products usually has to outsource the antenna design and the antenna manufacturing, because there are very few people other than the ham radio operators who understand that black art. Technology. Antenna design is a black art. There are people who think you have to make a Faustian bargain, a bargain with the devil, in order to acquire the knowledge to be an antenna engineer. It's an exaggeration, but it's a joke that's quite often used. You'd be amazed. And so if you have that knowledge, if you gain it by way of ham radio, and you become a reasonably good antenna designer, take it from me. It's a good thing to pursue. The schools don't teach it. You'll automatically have job security. You'll often automatically be treated almost like a king. People will beat a path to your door if you have a demonstrated track record of being able to design antennas on various frequencies. It's a good skill to pursue. There is no better way of getting the hands-on experience, the apprenticeship, than by way of ham radio. Let me drop. As I told you guys before, each of the companies that I've ever been in that have a real antenna engineering department, and there aren't very many of them, but you dig deep enough into that part, that department, you'll find some little old engineer in the back room, and you look at his bookshelf. Turned around backwards, what people can't see what it is the ARRL antenna book, the Radio Amateur's Handbook. Turned around forward is the JASIC Antenna Engineering Handbook, or the Velocic Antenna Engineering Handbook. A few of the Radiation Laboratory antenna books, but every one of them will have a copy of the ARRL antenna book, a ham radio book teaching them how to build military-grade antennas in many experiences. You'd be amazed how many times that's where the knowledge is coming from. You guys are in the right place. Okay. Whether or not you want to go to our next one, it's your choice, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Let's see if Paul may have a quick report, Dick.
And Paul, one of the beautiful things that I read this week, which may be something, I may be taking the wind out of your sail. Going to that website right now. Is this the one? Where the hell did I put it? Anyhow, the Board of Real Estate, whatever you want to call it, the state of Hawaii on the Big Island has just given approval this week on April 15th. They gave approval for the beginning of the construction of the TMT, the 30-meter telescope. When completed, unfortunately it's not going to be completed and anticipated until 2021, is a 98-foot diameter optical telescope, the biggest thing on planet Earth as an optical telescope. The European Southern Observatory is proposing a slightly larger one at a slightly later date, an overwhelmingly large telescope. So they're discovering as you build bigger and bigger optical telescopes with adaptive optics, you see more and more about what's going on in space. Can you imagine 98-foot diameter mirror, all built with 492 individual mirror cells, hexagonal mirror cells, all set together just right, and all of that diffraction limited, in other words, built to the nearest 20th of a wavelength, which is around 20 nanometers, approximately a micro inch, a millionth of an inch accuracy of a mirror 98 feet in diameter. That's a telescope. WS2N, go ahead, Paul.
A quick note, Dick.
Yeah, go ahead, John.
Just to let you know, I sent some photographs you might find interesting to your website, so when you get a chance, take a look at those.
I did see a few of them. The first one is a bloody-looking thing, and the others are pictures of a bridge and things like this. I saw a couple of them. Okay. Mauna Kea Mountain is going to be the highest thing on the mountain, the biggest thing ever, and it's the Board of Land and Natural Resources of the state of Hawaii on April 15th gave permission to build this thing. If you go to, it's a very long website, but if you just Google the word TMT or 30-meter telescope, you'll start finding websites on this thing, and what a monster, with a real fancy radome over it, very unusual looking. WS2N. What's NASA been doing? K2LIW, you got it, Paul.
Okay, this is WS2N.
about the one on Hawaii yet. And 98 feet is huge. The time frame till 2021 is pretty good, you know. I mean, if you think back, the original Hale telescopes and things like that were 20, 30 year projects. Some of them, you know, they drag stuff up a hill with mules and, you know, take forever. You know, was it Hale? It died before the thing was put into operation. So they would start these projects. They would have lived to see the mark, Palomar and all that. So I think it's a pretty good time frame. I just said a telescope topic, Kepler, let me drop it. And we discussed the new one that's being built, TESS, last week. But there was a news conference of some main scientists that are involved with Kepler. It was held this week, and they actually had what they consider breaking news, which are three almost Earth-sized planets that were located. Two in particular, they call them 62F and 62E. 62F being the small one, 1.4 radii. They go by the radii compared to Earth. Radius. So it's only a little bit bigger than Earth, and 62E is a little bit bigger than that, 1.6. So the important thing, of course, both of these are within the habitable zone, not possible. And anybody that follows the Kepler stories, they found, maybe 2,700 candidates and over 300, almost 400 confirmed planets. But they come up with this. Those are usually big planets where their orbital period is quick, sometimes days. Let me drop it. These two, and there was a third one too, these couple of planets, one of them is 122 days, and that's good, and the other one is 267 days, that's almost equivalent to one of our years, and that's what they're looking for, the longer period planets is one of the goals, and now they're starting to find that instead of 30 days, and they're finding hundreds of days now. And it's only a matter of time. The one guy was asked, if you had more money, if there was more money involved, and he had this elaborate question, so when the scientists came back to him, he told them, he goes, well, in other words, if we had an infinite amount of money, what would we build? And he said there would be a terrestrial planet finder type telescope that would look for different atmospheres, and it's technically possible, but the finances would have to be there. But there's no limit to what they could do, and you can see that now with 90 plus foot thing that you're talking about out in Hawaii. This WS-20. So you live long enough, the telescopes are only going to get bigger and bigger. There's going to be more and more of them in space. I don't know how many are floating around space now. And how many more planned with tests going up. And, another one that they're going to attach to the space station to one of the size neutron stars. And they got a lot of weird things. A matter of time before they have gravity wave detecting telescopes. And that'll be another whole form of astronomy that they could look into. That was the main topic, Kepler, and then, of course, what went on today at 5 o'clock, the Antares launch. Didn't get to see that. I know I let John know about it the other day, but it was delayed.
originally was supposed to go up Wednesday and then Friday. I think I let John know the latest date was Saturday, and it turned out to be today. And they had a beautiful blue sky to launch against. Drop it.
Traffic away from what is the principle of it?
They hit zero on the countdown. With that, it only had a 1.2-to-1 ratio for the weight, so about 750,000 pounds of thrust. And it is a liquid firing first stage, which is a little bit unusual. Like the shuttle has liquid engines, but they had solids attached to it, and they really go. The liquid engines tend to rise slowly. I think total burn was about 5 minutes on the first stage. It took about a minute before it ever got up to 100 miles an hour. I think the shuttle was at 100 miles an hour after it cleared the tower. So a very slow launch, but everything went 100% perfect. And anybody that doesn't know, this is another unmanned rocket by Orbital Sciences that they plan on eventually sending in a couple of months spies to the space station. Drop it. There are many companies that are involved with this idea of space competition among corporations. And you have four of them that actually have deals with NASA, billions of dollars being released to do stuff, manned programs, cargo refurbishing programs to the space station. You've got this Orbital Sciences that launched their Antares rocket today. You've got SpaceX that launches the Falcon rocket with the Dragon attached to it. You've got Sierra Nevada. They're coming online in a couple of years with the Dream Chaser, also going to be launched out of this Wallops Island. So you actually have people launched out of Wallops Island. And then even Boeing. Boeing's involved with a manned program. So this new facility in Virginia, Wallops Island, although it's been around since 1945, it's a new pad that was built. Actually, it was an old pad that was completely demolished a few years ago and rebuilt by this company, Orbital Sciences. Drop it. So here they are pouring money into this, building the pad themselves, building the launch vehicle, the Antares rocket, liquid stage rocket. The second stage was a solid booster, solid rocket. And that went well, too. It's strange, you know, after the first stage drops off, it takes about a minute before the second stage even lights up. So a couple of things happen. The fairings pop off. They had nice camera views. You could, you know, look back at toward Earth, you see the whole coastline of Virginia as this thing went off, and then you could see it the forward-facing camera when the fairings were released. You see the front end of what would normally be the Cygnus spacecraft. Now the company's building they built the launch facility, they built the rocket, and they're also building the Cygnus spacecraft that will eventually be attached and will have supplies on board. In fact, they already have supplies in it. It's at Wallops Island getting ready for a June launch. So, pretty interesting. It didn't make the news. I checked the news station. Drop it. Unfortunately, I didn't see it on some of the common cable stations I usually watch, but it was on the computer. I don't know if John got a chance to see it. I told him about it. I'd like to find out if he saw the launch. It could be seen from Long Island. If you went down by the shore, on the south shore, you would be able to see it. It went about 5 degrees above the horizon, and you won't be able to see it anymore. If you get down to Atlantic City, maybe, you know, 10, 15 degrees above the horizon. You go up on top of the Empire State Building, you'd have naturally a better shot. And that's pretty much it for Antares. If you have any questions, now it's time. Back to you, Dick. This is WS.
35, Paul. In a minute, I'm going to ask you guys if anybody saw Antares or tracked it on its website. But the beginning of your talk, Paul, was on the subject of Kepler. Kepler is that satellite that was launched a couple of years ago. It is completely spending all of its time staring at one little chunk of space near the constellation of Cygnus. Cygnus, if you're a star watcher from way back, Cygnus contains the double star called Albireo. Albireo is the one that's got a red and a blue star very close to each other. With a good-sized telescope, you can look at them many months during the year and resolve these two different color stars. Turns out every star has got color to it. Because of the way the human eye works, rods and cones, the cones are the color-detecting portion of your eye. That's the good news, they detect color. The bad news is that they're low in sensitivity. The rods of your eye are very high in sensitivity, but they only see monochromatically, black and white. As such, to a human eye, essentially all stars at night look white. Let me drop. You take any of your cameras, color camera, set it up on a tripod, open the lens for 20 minutes or whatever with the right kind of an exposure setting in a dark enough area, and you simply take a picture of the sky as the Earth slowly rotates and the sky and the stars sweep across your film. And you look at that picture, whether you make a print or a slide or whatever out of it, and you'll be amazed. The stars have almost all the colors of the rainbow. Green ones and red ones and blue ones and whatever, and orange ones, yellow ones. Those are the real colors of those stars. Your eye doesn't see them. The camera catches that. All right, Kepler is looking at this one tiny little space chunk of the constellation Cygnus, a very small fraction of the area of the moon it's looking at, and it's looking at more than 100,000 stars simultaneously. This telescope has all of these stars coming down the tube of the telescope going into this focal plane array. It's got a whole lot of charge couple device focal plane arrays, and they're very carefully doing calorimetry measurements. In other words, they're measuring the exact brightness of more than 100,000 stars simultaneously. Let me drop. Now for those 100,000 stars, a small percentage of them are properly aligned so that the plane of the orbit of the planet around those stars just happens to line up with our line of sight to the Kepler telescope. So that when a planet passes in front of the star, you get a dimming of the star that lasts for anything from a couple of minutes to a fraction of an hour, maybe it's even an hour, and the dimming you're looking at, because the planet's got a very small area compared to the area of the star, you're getting a dimming of a couple of parts per million in billions. And Kepler has got all the right computing hardware in there that it very carefully measures the exact brightness of 100,000 stars and look for that dimming event. And the dimming event has got a very specific shape to it. It's the shape of a trapezoid. As the planet is crossing in front of the limb of the star, you see the slope of dimming, only parts per million, but you see it. While the planet traverses the center of the star, you see the down portion of the trapezoid. And then when the star exits out the right-hand limb, so to speak, if the planet is sweeping from left to right, you'll see the rise of the brightness coming out of the star. You look at that shape, you study the spectrum and whatever, you find out what is the period of the planet, what's the size of the planet, what's the size of the star, how far away, is it in the Goldilocks zone where liquid water could exist. And so those planets that Paul is now talking about, 2,700 candidates, 300 have been confirmed so far, and the 62 Echo and 62 Foxtrot are the Earth-like planets that have most recently been discovered. We're going to be discovering a whole lot of them. The bottom line is kind of obvious from this. Let me drop. We're suddenly discovering that essentially all the stars have planets. A significant percentage of the stars have planets of the right size in the right region of that star. No, it's a small percentage. We used to think that planets are one per million, and a desirable planet is one per million of those stars having planets. We used to think of one per million. We're suddenly discovering that essentially all stars have got planets. And even if there's only one star per, one desirable star per thousand solar systems out there, that's still a lot of life out there. You got 10 to the 11 stars, 100 billion stars in this galaxy, and 100 billion observable galaxies. Big numbers. So even if the percentages are small, the total amount of life has to be large. We ain't alone. And as you've heard me say so often, it is my philosophy, let me drop. My philosophy is that we've got a nice sized star, not the biggest, not the smallest. We've got a very desirable place in our planet location. Nice sized planet, not too big, not too small, not too hot, not too cold. We're halfway between downtown and the suburbs of this galaxy. Slightly larger than a normal sized galaxy. A local galactic group that's kind of ordinary. You put it all together. We ain't the center of the universe. We ain't the center of anything. Of all the life that's out there, I'm convinced that half of it, technologically speaking, is ahead of us, and half of it is behind us. Of the 4.5 billion years of the life of this particular planet, of the 5 billion years of this particular sun that we like, it's only the last few hundred years where the life is has advanced to the point where significant, by our standards, technological progress is taking place. We're building some good satellites, some good telescopes, and we're starting to find out what's out there. How did it get there? Where are we with relation to it? Are we alone? I'm convinced that, as you've heard me say so often, of all the life that's out there, half of it's ahead of us, half of it's behind us. We're in the middle. We're not at the leading edge, we're not at the trailing edge. We're in the middle somewhere. Are we at the 65% or the 45%? We can argue about that. We're in the middle. There's a lot of life out there. And the way life makes progress is to have curiosity. We are curious. That's why we build these machines. Why NASA is funded, why we fund them to build these machines. Kepler, Hubble, what's the name of the intruder? When I keep forgetting the name of James Webb and all these others.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
We're building those machines because we're curious and because we like what we see. We get some very pretty pictures telling us a lot about our origin. You know, origin over the last 5 billion years. Of a 13.5 or 13.8 billion year universe, that is the particular universe we're in. And there's multiple universes out there. Mankind makes progress because they're curious. Those guys out there, the ones that have made progress, they're curious. They're curious about us. So I can give you all kinds of speculation and great science fiction stories. Alrighty, anybody got any further questions for Paul, me, John, the triumvirate, the troika. The troika that does a little bit of net control. If you've got any questions for any of us before we proceed, give me your call letters right now.
Dick. The gravitational telescope. I'm wondering, it's concentrating on the particle of gravity. What is the concept of it?
Yeah, the so-called LIGO experiment is a great big experiment, which I think is taking place in northern Texas. I think there's two of them or three of them worldwide. You've got this very long evacuated tube, a couple of miles long, and you're sending light back and forth in it, this laser light, bouncing off these optically flat first surface mirrors that are being very carefully mounted in a shock mounting, a low shock mount experiment, so that as you bounce the light back and forth, many, many times, many, many miles, the philosophy is that a gravity wave coming along is going to change the velocity of propagation by the so-called Einstein equation. Whenever light passes near a heavy object, it changes its velocity. That's why you get gravity lensing. Certain galaxies out there are very massive, and when you've got a galaxy that's very far away, and midway you've got another very massive one, the very massive one acts like a double convex lens to give you a lensing effect. The light bends around it, and therefore the far galaxy, you see it as a ring of stuff that has a very characteristic shape. So there's a few of those out there. The LIGO experiment, built on Earth, is looking for a gravity wave. The philosophy is that after you get a good-sized supernova or a pair of neutron stars combining, things like that, you're going to develop a gravity wave, and as the gravity wave supposedly moves at the speed of light and propagates to and through the Earth, it's going to change the velocity of propagation of the LIGO experiment. That, in turn, is going to knock it out of phase. You've got a very careful phase interferometer being built there, and so the phase change will tell you that a gravity wave just passed by.
I don't see a focusing mechanism.
No, there's no focusing mechanism. It's a carefully constructed laser beam bounced many times between mirrors, and there's one tunnel that goes north-south and one tunnel that goes east-west.
No, you don't understand. By your description, we just getting what is the strongest. We not able to focus on the particular area of interest.
If you look at the differential difference of the east-west, which you could call it the x-axis, and the north-south, which you could call the y-axis, that helps you locate the approximate direction of arrival of the gravity wave. It's not a perfect telescope, but to my knowledge, they haven't had a clearly defined event on the LIGO experiment that says, yes, there it is, we've seen a gravity wave pass by. Lots and lots of experiments have proceeded. Turns out that measuring gravity at all, a gravity wave at all, is extremely difficult. Once you perfect the technique for gravity measurement, a gravity wave measurement at all, then you can start talking about refining it so that you get an X, Y, and Z component. Well, it'd be nice if the LIGO experiment also had a Z component. If you had a third tunnel that goes into the Earth by a few miles, obviously the degree of difficulty and the cost of that is such that that third one hasn't been built yet. Let's see first if you can get a recognizable response out of the X and Y direction. That's where they stand right now. And if you Google the word LIGO, L-I-G-O, gravity detector, you'll see where the progress is. And they're refining it better and better, but still I don't think they've made a clearly defined intercept, clearly defined measurement yet. And so is the experiment going to have to be expanded in some way before we can really detect? And is a gravity wave detectable at all? Everyone wants to believe it. Of all the forces in the universe, let me back up.
There was a simple technique which used the scales, comparison of known weights, length of the foot loom, and they utilize the fact that the extension of spring is directly proportional to the weight of applied mass.
The LIGO is a few million times more sensitive than the experiment that you just described, Wes. There's been a whole lot of measurements over the last couple of hundred years to try to measure gravity waves. You could fairly safely say essentially no clearly defined success has occurred yet. Of all the forces in the universe, gravity is the one that's very difficult to understand. Einstein spent a good fraction of his life trying to find out how to relate gravity to all the other forces that are known. And lots and lots of theories, lots and lots of apparent measurements, no real success yet. When it comes to the specific amount of gravity you have when a satellite is passing over the moon, over the Earth, when a when a submarine, when a nuclear submarine is moving over various portions of the Earth, we have very carefully mapped the gravity mountains and valleys, so to speak. In other words, because of mass concentrations in the Earth in certain locations, let me drop, the exact amount of gravity you get on top of the mountain, in a valley, when you go to the top of a tall building, and you've got a good gravity measuring instrument, you can easily measure the difference in gravity that you will experience at the top of the building versus down at street level. That's easy. And a mapping of that allows a submarine below the surface to know where it is without even coming up to the surface. You recognize the pattern of the local gravity concentrations in the Earth as you travel through the water. And these two satellites that have been put around the moon have now allowed you to do a very accurate gravity assessment of where are all the mass concentrations on the moon. So when it comes to that kind of gravity, steady state gravity measurements of something like Earth or moon, relatively easy by comparison. But to measure a gravity wave propagated in space because of an event somewhat like a supernova, that's millions of times more difficult. But that kind of a gravity wave detection would give you a lot more information as to what's going on in space. And the day will come when not only can we measure gravity waves, but maybe be able to generate gravity waves. And maybe that's going to be the best way to do communication at the extraterrestrial distances. Maybe. Who knows? And if you know how to modulate gravity, maybe you can really modulate it a whole lot and make a vehicle that floats over the Earth and ignores gravity. That would be nice. There's lots of science fiction about that. It's a fun kind of science fiction to really do it. Wow. What is gravity? We know the more mass you put into a particular place, the more gravity you get. And the Higgs boson supposedly is related to all of that. I don't quite see the relationship yet. Ain't smart enough on that.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Can any of you guys out there explain the Higgs boson? I think if I'm looking at my watch correctly, yeah, we're about to run out of time. You've just listened to TechNet number 1445 of the series. I learned a lot. this cachet and archives of past websites that nothing ever disappears from the international, from the World Wide Web. Oh boy, that's going to allow me to find thousands of words that I wrote more than a decade ago. Bye bye, you all. Be kind to each other. John, say a few words, and you may have to go over to the other repeater to make it.
And the only way you're going to get through is through the Eastern Link if you happen to be able to get the job. Bye bye, all, and be kind to each other. Keep your eyes pretty clear and listening.
United, great net. United, everyone on the net, up in Canada. A good time. And I believe you can hear me from here. That's KCWGB. Be safe for 2 weeks. Every week is over the week.
KP2WGB, WS2N. John, did you get to see the launch?
And we heard you very well, John. Go right ahead. Did you see the launch?
Well, I thought it was Saturday night. You were coming Saturday at 5. I didn't know it was done something. I didn't get a chance to see it yet, but we'll check it out on the web.
Okay, I guess somebody's going to have it on YouTube somewhere, or maybe NASA. But, okay, yeah, no, I told you originally Friday, and then I got back in, and it was until Saturday, and then high winds up in the upper atmosphere. If something goes wrong, those winds would bring debris back to land, but that was canceled, and they made it for today, 5 o'clock, doesn't happen. You have to follow that along. I mean, originally it was supposed to be Wednesday. The data cable pulled out, and that was the end of that. And by the way, there's a ham satellite on that thing. If you listen for the next couple of weeks on 70 centimeters, 437.425, 437.425, You should be able to hear where our transmission coming down. And then they want you to send it.